Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on extremist traits when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, don't we? And we've been taught from early childhood that anybody who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, a law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about these young budding lawyers. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said, it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax, unquote. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget. Hey, we've been talking about Laird Wilcox, and Laird Wilcox wrote a treatise here on extremist traits. If you'd like a copy of this report, it's www.webtattoo.com. www.webtattoo.com. That's spelled W-E-B-T-A-T-T-O-O, all one word. Last time we were up to extremist trait number 14. Let me refresh your recollection here, as we say in court. Sir, let me refresh your recollection by showing you this exhibit. Extremists may deliberately lie, distort, misquote, slander, defame, or libel their opponents and or critics, engage in censorship or repression. Hey, are we engaging in censorship or repression here in the United States? Have you tried to get on an airplane lately? Do you think that taking all of your toothpaste and your shaving cream and all the stuff out and throwing it in the garbage, does that sound like repression to you? It kind of sounded like repression to me. And what about these politicians, you know, like our president and secretary of state? You know, they said we've got weapons of mass destruction over in Iraq, and then when we got over there, there aren't any. They said this Saddam Hussein is developing nuclear weapons, and then when we got to looking at it, no, he wasn't doing that either. And hasn't it just about proven out that every claim that President Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld made at the beginning of this war has been proven to be false? Can you tell me one thing that the president said that was true in 2003 and is still true today in 2006? Send me an email, would you, and let me know what true statements the president made about Saddam Hussein or about the war or about the weapons or about our purpose, about saving Iraq for democracy or trying to preserve democracy or establish democracy in Iraq or whatever it's going to be. Name one. I'm at a loss. So when I got to number 14, we find that extremists believe that it's okay to do bad things in the service of a good cause. If we have to claim that there are weapons of mass destruction to get the American people behind the war, then that's okay. We'll do that. If we have to lie to them and tell them that this Saddam Hussein is a bad guy and that we need to get rid of him because he's got weapons of mass destruction like nuclear weapons, or he's developing these weapons of mass destruction, then that's okay. Hey, isn't that what we're being told about the Iranians? And while we're talking about nuclear weapons over here, let me ask you a question. Are you really disturbed that Israel has the bomb? Does that really bother you? Does it really bother you that India or Pakistan has the bomb? Does it bother you so much that you're ready to go to war with India, Pakistan, or Israel to take that bomb away from them? Because I'm not. Now, maybe I'm the only guy in America that's not really prepared to go to war and get killed or kill a bunch of other people over Pakistan's nuclear weapons or India's nuclear weapons. You know, I couldn't care less whether the Iranians develop a nuclear weapon or not. Now, I want to point out to you that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis did not attack the United States of America. Now, I know our president told us that Iraq was a bunch of bad guys over there and we needed regime change. And I pointed this out the other day. I said, you get attacked by 19 Arabians, so you attack the Iraqis. That's like being attacked by 19 Syrians, so you attack Cairo, Egypt. I don't know where in the hell our brains were, but somewhere along the line, they convinced us that, well, they know these Iraqis over here are bad guys, and if they didn't attack us last week, they're going to attack us next week. And that may be true. That may be true. But, you know, we didn't go to war against Japan until they attacked us. And now we've got a new system over here. It's called preemptive war. You go to war against Iran because they might pose a problem. That kind of reminds me of a lady who had a long history in her family of having breast cancer. I think her mother had breast cancer, and her grandmother had breast cancer, and maybe her great-grandmother had breast cancer, and her sisters had breast cancer. And so this lady, she went in and had both of her breasts cut off. Cut them both off. It was preemptive surgery, she said, and she was really happy that she did that because she was convinced that she was going to develop breast cancer just like her parents did. And so to prevent developing breast cancer, she cut her breasts off. Well, by God, she was right about one thing. She's never going to develop breast cancer. But do you do the same thing if you had a long history, let's say, of brain tumors or brain cancer? Do we cut our heads off to make sure that we don't get a brain tumor? Now, somewhere along the line here, kids, I think that our common sense has fled us. When the Japanese attack, you go back over and you take care of the problem. I mean, that's the way it's always been down here on the docks. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression, you know, that every time you go into a bar, you're going to get into a fight. But, you know, fights do happen, and they happen pretty frequently in bars, especially down around the docks. And I mentioned this the last couple times, that, you know, if you want to look for trouble, just go into a bar and start butting into somebody else's conversation, and there should be some blood and teeth on the floor there pretty shortly. But on the other hand, you know, most of the guys that go in the bar, you know, they sit down, have a couple drinks, talk with their friends, and have a good time, get up and walk out, and everything is fine. We don't have a problem. We Americans seem to be butting into everybody's business around the world. And as a result of that, we seem to have more problems with more barroom brawls than any other country in the world. In fact, if you take a look at it, I was reading a book the other day called Rogue Nation, America, the Rogue Nation. And they pointed out that we Americans have been involved in 127, by count, 127 wars or military conflicts or military actions since 1900. 127, he said, count them. Or no, I'll take that back, in our history. He went back to 1787. He said, in our history. 227 years, you got 127 wars. That's about one war every 2 years. You know, round numbers. Every 2 years, Americans are involved in some war somewhere or fighting somebody somewhere over something. Well, you know, there are people that attract trouble. And Americans seem to attract more trouble than anybody else in the world. Just looking around, you know, at the Swedes and the Swiss, they seem to butt out. They seem to mind their own business, and they haven't been involved in very many wars. Now, the British and the Americans seem to stick their nose in a lot of times where it doesn't belong, and especially in the Middle East, and we're not very well liked there. Now, I wanted to point out that 100 years ago, we didn't have this problem with Al-Qaeda. We didn't have this problem with the Muslims or with the Muslim world, but it kind of got started around 1948, about the time, you know, that we decided that the Jews needed a homeland. And the king of Saudi Arabia said, well, why don't you give those Jews a homeland in Germany? Why don't you give those Jews a homeland in America? Why are you coming over here to make a homeland out of our ground? I guess it'd be about like this. You go over to your neighbor and you say, I'm going to appropriate 5 acres of your land over here, neighbor, from my mother-in-law. I got to have a place for her, so I think I'll just take your ground and put her over here. Do you think that might cause you some heartache and some grief with your neighbor? Well, that's what we did with the Jews, and sure enough, it stirred up a lot of hate and discontent over there. That's why I pointed out a couple programs ago. Seems like to me that we could take Wyoming under eminent domain, pay all the people in Wyoming off in $100 bills and let them go their way in peace, and then give Wyoming to the Jews and let the Arabs take back Palestine, and I think we'd all be money ahead. Bottom line, I think we'd all be money ahead. And then we could get rid of this problem, and the Jews would have much more ground, a whole lot more coal, and have more money. Everybody would be happier. Well, Laird Wilcox put together these extremist traits, and there are certain traits that go along with extreme behavior. Not to say that Osama bin Laden isn't an extremist. He probably is. But Wilcox points out that these traits are the traits of extremists. This is a psychological profile of extremists, and our president, our vice president, and secretary of defense, Donald Rumsfeld, so far I've done 14 of them, and they've got all 14 traits. And we got 7 more to go. So let's take a look at number 14. Remember, the extremists may deliberately lie, distort, misquote, slander, defame, or libel their opponents and or their critics and engage in censorship or repression. Isn't that what Guantanamo is, repression? Censorship. Isn't that secrecy? And to undertake violence in special cases. Isn't this war in Iraq violence? And aren't we trying to defeat the terrorists? And this is done with little or no remorse as long as it's in the service of defeating the communists or fascists or terrorists. I don't know that there's been very much remorse over Abu Ghraib or 3,700 Iraqis dying every month. I mean, that's just a statistic. Old Joe Stalin, I think, hit the nail on the head. He said, when one person dies, it's a tragedy. When a million people die, it's a statistic. And that's all you're dealing with here. Three Americans die, it's a tragedy. 3,700 Iraqis die every month, it's just a statistic. And defeating your enemy becomes all-encompassing. It's the goal to which other values are subordinate. Isn't that where the president is? So I asked this question. I said, okay, let's stay the course. Let's stay in Iraq for 25 years. Let's spend, I don't know, $100 billion a year on the Iraq war for the next 25 years. When you get through, what is it that you're going to have 25 years from now that you don't already have today? What is it that you're going to have less of 25 years from now that you have more of today and you'd like to hang on to? Well, we're going to have a lot more dead bodies, and we're going to spend a lot more money. And when we get through in 25 years, are we going to have whatever it is that our president says that our goal is in the war with Iraq, which God only knows what that goal is. I don't know what it is. In World War II, it was total unconditional surrender of the Japanese. And one day the Japanese said, okay, we got it. We're going to totally and unconditionally surrender. And General MacArthur sailed into Tokyo Bay and sat down with those Japs on the battleship Missouri, having signed some papers, and the war was over, and we won, and you lost, and the deal is done. Is that what we're doing in Iraq? That there's coming a time when Osama bin Laden is going to sit down with General Franks or somebody, or whoever the guy's running the show at that time is going to be, and is going to sign the deal and say, okay, we lose, you win, and now let's get on with life. Is that the goal? Is that where we're headed? I remember when this thing got started back in 2003, the president said, well, this war is going to be a long one. Hell, it could be 10, 20, 30 years. Well, I can understand his logic, because war makes a lot of money, and if we can convince you people that war is where we want to go for the next 10, 20, or 30 years, I mean, that makes a lot of money for Halliburton and Boeing and Lockheed Martin. I'm not so sure that it does anything for George Gordon or Joe Sixpack, but you know, that's what they're selling. They're selling war. Do you want to buy more war? If that's what you want to buy, stick with the program. I notice the Democrats are sitting there saying, well, we want to support our troops in Iraq. Okay. So what else is obvious in life? Could we support our troops in Iraq by loading them on an airplane and sending them back to Milwaukee, Wisconsin? You know, if we pulled every American soldier out of Iraq in the morning and then let the Iraqis go to hell in a handbasket, what would that cost? What would that do? And somebody says, oh my God, chaos would ensue. Okay, well, isn't that what ensued in South Vietnam? Chaos. And then they had a civil war, and when it was all said and done, the South was put down, the North won, and now they've got peace over there. Peace will break out in Iraq, boys and girls, when the Americans leave. Now, you've heard that over and over again. And, of course, number 14 says, well, defeating the enemy becomes an all-encompassing goal in which other values are totally subordinate. With extremists, the end justifies the means. I don't even know what the hell the end is. So if you know what the end of this is and what it is that we're over there fighting for, could you articulate that in an email? Could you put that down in 25 words or less? With the Japanese, it was very simple. We want total, unconditional surrender. Is that what we're looking for with Al-Qaeda? At least that would tell us where we're headed. All right, number 15 here. Emphasis on emotional responses and correspondingly less importance attached to reasoning and logical analysis. Reasoning and logical analysis. I thought about that war over there, and I said, if every American pulled out in the morning, 10 o'clock, and left the Iraqis to themselves, there is no doubt in my mind but what they would degenerate into civil war. The Shiites and the Sunnis would get after it. And if I was going to pick a winner, I'd pick the Shiites, because there's more of them. And when they get all through with it, I think the Shiites are going to whip the Sunnis, and I think when it's all said and done, the Shiites will put together some kind of a government, probably a religious government like they've got over in Iran, something that's totally unacceptable to Walmart, Exxon, Standard Oil, Boeing, General Electric, General Motors, and Ford. I'm sure that the major multinational corporations will just be devastated. That is not what they want. And I'm sitting here saying, so what? What do I care? I'm not being flip. I'm just telling you, so? How does that affect George Gordon? We're not getting any oil out of Iraq anyway. Hell, we have to import oil into Iraq. We have to import gasoline in there. They're not producing enough gasoline for the Iraqis, for crying out loud. So it sure as hell ain't oil that we're after over there, because if it is, we've spent $1 trillion on 100 billion barrels of oil, and when it's all said and done, we got to ship oil in there. We'd be money ahead. We would have lower gas prices in America if we just got the hell out of there. And after all, lower gas prices is what concerns me. I don't really care about democracy in North Korea. Do you? Are you just real concerned about that and just jumping up and down, pawing the ground, biting the bushes, saying, oh, my God, I won't be able to sleep until the North Koreans have democracy in North Korea and freedom? You know, under Saddam Hussein, the Iraqis didn't have an income tax, and they didn't have gun control. And now they've got both, income tax and gun control. Isn't that just special? And we're the people with the Second Amendment that says we have a right to keep and bear arms, and we got 25,000 gun laws in the United States. And we're exporting our 25,000 gun laws to the Iraqis. I wonder if those insurgents over there say, hell no, we won't go. Maybe they don't want to buy into the Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein gun control program. Has it ever occurred to us that maybe we ought to sit down with the insurgents at some point in time, like we did with the Viet Cong, at some point in time, at some place on planet Earth, and say, what in the hell is it that you guys want? What is it that's bugging you? Number 15 calls for an emphasis on emotional responses and correspondingly less importance attached to reasoning and logical analysis. Have you heard any reasoning or logical analysis coming out of the president? I was a little disappointed in the Baker Commission because I didn't think it was too logical to go to Iran and Syria and say, hey, would you help us bring peace to Iraq? You know, if I was sitting over there at Iran, I would be over there laughing up my sleeve. These people have to be totally insane to even entertain such a preposterous notion. And one of the commission reports, or one of the commission members, was Sandra Day O'Connor. It was a former justice of the Supreme Court. Now, I always thought that woman had a pretty good head on her shoulders. I don't know, kids. I told you about that one in the last program. I said, just walk into a bar, pick on some little guy, beat the living hell out of him, then go over and pick on the biggest guy in the bar and let him beat the hell out of you. And then while he's beating the hell out of you, you go over to this little guy that you just whipped a few minutes before and tell him to help you with this big guy and see how that's going to fly. I mean, come on, kids. I haven't been to college yet, but I ain't brain dead. And this came out of that commission. Now, extremists have an unspoken reverence for propaganda, which they may call education or consciousness raising. Symbolism plays an exaggerated role in their thinking, and they tend to think imprecisely and metamorphically. Harold D. Laswell, in his book, Psychopathology in Politics, says this. He said, the essential mark of the agitator is the high value that he places on the emotional response of the public. Effective extremists tend to be effective propagandists. Propaganda differs from education in that the former teaches one what to think and the latter teaches one how to think. Propaganda differs from education. Now, hasn't our president told us what to think? I mean, we've been following the president now for 6 years on this deal. And it would seem like to me that number 15 just fits right in there with President Bush like a glove. And so now these extremists have unspoken reverence for propaganda. Stay the course. Stay the course. And we're making progress in Iraq. I'm sitting here saying, what if we're making progress in Iraq? Somebody said, well, we got to rebuild Iraq. And I'm saying, why in the hell don't we rebuild West Virginia? Why don't we go down and rebuild New Orleans? Why in the hell do we have to go to Baghdad, destroy the place, and then rebuild it? As if we didn't have anything else to do in life? I mean, I don't know. I'm just Joe Sixpack sitting out here. But last year, a big hurricane hit New Orleans. I don't know how much money they're going to spend down there, but somebody threw a number out, $500 billion. That's about how much money we've spent on the Iraq War. In the Iraq War, we've killed 3,000 Americans, crippled 20,000, killed 650,000 Iraqis, and when it's all said and done, the Iraqis have less electricity today than they had then. They still don't have democracy. They've got sewage running down their streets, and there's 3,700 people a month being killed over there. What did the Baker Commission say? It's grave and deteriorating. All right. Some guy was on Lair the other day and said, I'll tell you what the solution in Iraq is we got to spend more money on security and building the infrastructure. Did you hear that? More money on security and building the infrastructure. Is President Bush slack on spending money? Maybe spending all the money he can borrow. So when I suggest that we go down to West Virginia or New Orleans or someplace and spend the money here at home and let's rebuild New Orleans or let's rebuild West Virginia or let's go rebuild Chicago or the slums of Los Angeles or, you know, let's go build a fence down on the Mexican border. Surely there are some construction projects here in the United States that will benefit us Americans at least as much and probably more than it's going to benefit the Iraqis. Now, I don't doubt that it's going to hurt Halliburton, Kellogg Brown & Root, Bechtel, General Electric, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and a lot of other multinational corporations, to which I say, to hell with them. The hell do I care about Lockheed Martin? I don't have any Lockheed stock. I really don't give a rat's ass whether the people at Lockheed have a job tomorrow morning or not. It's irrelevant to me. I don't care. I really don't care anymore about the people down in New Orleans or West Virginia. But just as a matter of reason, logic, and common sense, my common sense says to me as an American, it just makes more sense to go spend the money in New Orleans. If we're just hell-bent on, we just got to spend this money, then why don't we go spend it on our fellow Americans? But rather than spend it on New Orleans, I could see going out here to Wyoming and spending the money in developing oil shale and making America energy independent and telling the Arabs to take their oil and stick it where there's no daylight. Now, I could see some sense in that. So I don't want you guys down in New Orleans to think that I'm a socialist welfarer down here and I just want to spend money down here to help you people down here in New Orleans, because I don't. Not a dime. But, you know, it still makes more sense to me to spend money on my fellow Americans in New Orleans than it does to spend it on a bunch of screwballs over in Iraq or Iran or North Korea or Vietnam or some other far-flung spot out here in the world where we're just hell-bent on spending money on some war somewhere so we can kill a bunch of people and profit Lockheed. Now we got one here called number 16. Number 16, hypersensitivity and vigilance. Listen to this. Extremists perceive hostile innuendo and even casual comments, imagine rejection, and they imagine antagonism concealed in honest disagreement and dissent. They see latent subversion, anti-Semitism, and perversion, racism, disloyalty, and so on in innocent gestures and ambiguous behaviors. Although few extremists are clinically paranoid, many of them adopt a paranoid style with its attendant hostility and distrust. You ever watch President Bush? Just compare him to Osama bin Laden. When I watch bin Laden, he seems to be confident, straightforward, stands up. He says, here's what I think. I watch Bush, and every time I watch that guy, I say to myself, this guy appears to me to be paranoid. He's extremely sensitive to criticism. And when somebody suggests that, well, Mr. President, have you got a bad policy over here in Iraq? I mean, you'd have to be brain dead not to say, hey, listen, this isn't one of my better ideas. I got to concede, kids. I mean, if the guy got up there and he said, listen, we got into this war because, you know, they attacked us, and so we got to pay them back. And I would say, now that we've killed 216 of them for every one of those Americans that died in the trade towers, I think that's enough. Now let's come on back home. No, sir. The other day I saw the president, and he didn't quite say stay the course. He's changed his tune now. It ain't stay the course. It's got to be until the mission is completed. I asked you this question the last time, and I've asked it two or three times here. Send me an email. Tell me what the hell this mission's all about, would you? If you're a Republican, if you're a conservative, and if you're in favor of the war, if you're a soldier in the Army, if you're the wife of a soldier who believes in this war, my God, send me an email and let me know what in the hell is the mission. Where are we going with this? I haven't got a clue. But the president, he's very emotional about this. He's hypersensitive. And boy, is he vigilant. I've been watching the guy. And he hates disloyalty. Mr. President, I don't mean to be disloyal. I just want you to come up with some kind of an intelligent conclusion and say, okay, we're going to stay here for 25 years. And we're staying for 25 years because we haven't spent enough money yet. We want to spend 10, 15, 20 billion, no, no, 10, 15, 20 trillion dollars on Iraq. My God, they haven't got enough oil over there to spend that kind of money on. We could spend, you know, one-tenth that kind of money, develop all of our own oil out here. We've got 3.6 trillion barrels of it. We don't need to spend any money on Iraq trying to make the world safe for democracy. We don't need their oil. Let's take the same amount of money or one-tenth of the same amount of money and go spend it on our own oil development. The only people that are interested in developing oil in the Middle East is Exxon and Shell. As far as we Americans are concerned, let them go develop oil in the Middle East. What do I care? And then if they've got problems over there in the Middle East with those governments, let them go solve their own problems. It's their investment. Now, if they want to invest money out here and develop oil, Shell, that's fine. If they want to spend their money to go develop oil in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, that's fine. But why do we have to go over there and fight to make the world safe for Standard Oil and Shell and Exxon? I don't quite follow that line of reasoning. And while we're not following that line of reasoning, let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And if you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed, or generally isn't totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. While we're talking about giving credit where credit's due, the guy that wrote this report is named Laird Wilcox. And you can get a copy of the report. It's www.webtattoo.com. That's spelled webtattoo.com. Webtattoo.com, Laird Wilcox. Called Extremist Traits. All right, number 17, use of supernatural rationale for beliefs and actions. Some extremists, particularly those involved in cults or extreme religious movements such as fundamentalist Christians, militant Zionist extremists, and members of mystical and metaphysical organizations, claim some kind of supernatural rationale for their beliefs and actions, and that their movement or cause is ordained by God. Isn't that what I heard from George Bush the other day? Didn't he tell us that he has a mission and that he's been commissioned by God himself to do this? He may be right. I'm not denying that God may have, or a God, or Satan, or Lucifer, somebody might have directed him to do this. But I would take exception to the claim that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has authorized this, because he's not following any of the war statutes or any of the Ten Commandments in following this war in Iraq. There isn't any of the statutes, judgments, or commandments that we received from Moses being applied here to the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Now, it is true that in the war in Afghanistan, we did have a rational basis called self-defense. The Al-Qaeda people did come from Afghanistan, and they were being protected by the Taliban government there. But this Iraq thing over here, I don't think there's any basis at all. And the Afghanistan war doesn't have the correct basis. That is, the Chief Justice needed to walk out on the battlefield with his censer. I'm just reporting to you that when God told us, you know, to go to war, he would have Aaron the high priest go out on the battlefield first. First guy out there. And then God would approve the war, or he would disapprove. And if he disapproved, that means we retreat. If he approves of it, we go like hell. Let's attack. Let's get after it. Now, George Bush didn't have those in DC going for him, but he did claim, at least that's what I have heard him say myself a time or two, and I construed that as being that I've got this mandate from God, or I've got this permission from God, or I've got this duty that has been imposed upon me by God to rid the world of extremists, to rid the world of these terrorists. Now, in this case, stark extremism may become reframed in a religious context, which can have a legitimizing effect for some people. It's surprising how many people are reluctant to challenge religiously motivated extremism because it represents religious belief or because of the sacred cow status of some religions in our culture. George Bush now has enjoyed the religious right as what they call the conservative base. And I'm not opposed to religion. I'm not opposed to the religious right or the religious left or anybody else. Everybody's entitled to their religious views and opinions. I believe in free speech. I'm not opposed to that at all. But when George Bush comes out and he says, well, you know, I'm sent by God to do this, and I'm sitting here saying, uh-oh, it ain't the same God that I heard about in the Bible. And there's lots of gods out there, and he's evidently selected one. There was another little thing in here that kind of caught my eyeball. Did you know that George Bush is a member of Skull and Bones? He's an officer. He's a you know, a lifetime member of the Skull and Bones organization. His daddy was, and his granddaddy, Prescott Bush, was. Hey, you know, when you got Skull and Bones guys in the White House now, that's pretty heavy-duty stuff. Skull and Bones. So anyway, there's that story, and he's involved in a cult. And I would say that Skull and Bones is a cult. It's a witchcraft cult. Number 18, problems tolerating ambiguity and uncertainty. Ambiguity and uncertainty. Indeed, the ideologies and belief systems to which extremists tend to attach themselves often represent grasping for certainty in an uncertain world, or an attempt to achieve absolute security in an environment that is naturally unpredictable, or perhaps populated by people with interests opposed to their own. Extremists exhibit a kind of risk aversiveness that compels them to engage in controlling and manipulative behavior, both on a personal level and in a political context, to protect themselves from the unforeseen and the unknown. The more laws or rules there are that regulate the behavior of others, particularly their enemies, the more secure these extremists feel. Now, did you notice that our president here, he feels real comfortable with the Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, Homeland Security, Abu Ghraib, preemptive war, Guantanamo. And, you know, I take a look at all of that and I say, well, where did that come from? That's not Anglo-Saxon belief and practice. Extremists exhibit a kind of risk aversiveness that compels them to engage in controlling and manipulative behavior. Why is it that we need to control and manipulate the Iranians in their nuclear program? I would be the first to tell you that I don't think that Iran having a nuclear bomb is a good idea, or North Korea, or Brazil, or the Falkland Islands, or Rwanda, or Burundi, or Egypt, or anybody else. Hell, I don't even think that the United States, China, and Russia, England, and France should have nuclear weapons. I don't think nuclear weapons in the hands of any man anywhere is a very good idea. But why is it that our president has to manipulate and control the Iranians in their development of nuclear weapons? What would we think over here if the Iranians were doing the same thing to us that we are doing to them? The old adage is, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, comes into play. I don't think that Americans would sit still for the Iranians dictating to us whether or not we're going to develop a hydrogen bomb or an atomic bomb, or we're going to enrich uranium or enrich bat guano, for that matter. I don't think that we would sit still for it. Well, what the hell makes us think that the Iranians are going to sit still for it? And why is it that we Americans feel that it's our duty in life to go over here and dictate how other people ought to live in Iran or Afghanistan or Iraq or North Korea or someplace else? Why is it our duty, why is it our responsibility to bring democracy to North Korea or to bring democracy to Iraq? Who gives a rat's rectum one way or the other as to what kind of government they have? Hell, I got a problem with the kind of government that we've got. You know, I'm real concerned about having people look up my rectum before I get on an airplane. I didn't used to have to do that. I'd kind of like to repeal Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, and the Homeland Security Program. Let's suppose that George Bush succeeds, and we have total unconditional surrender of Al-Qaeda and all the terrorists. And they say, okay, you Americans win. Does that mean then that we can repeal Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, Homeland Security, and get back to living a normal life again? Could we do that? I think you'd have to be a dreamer if you thought that's the way that game is going to be played. Now, the Democrats have taken over Congress, and if you elect a Democrat as president in 2008, I'll just bet you that you're not going to have a repeal of Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, and Homeland Security under the Democrats. You're just going to have more tyranny, more people control. Now, that's what my President George Bush sounds like today, and I just thought I'd report that. That's Laird Wilcox reporting number 18. That's the kind of behavior that we're getting out of our president. Number 19, inclination toward groupthink. Extremists, their organizations, and their subcultures are prone to a kind of inward-looking group cohesiveness that leads to what Irving Janis discussed in his book, Victims of Groupthink. Groupthink involves a tendency to conform to group norms and to preserve solidarity and concurrence at the expense of distorting members' observations of facts, conflicting evidence, and disquieting observations that would call into question the shared assumptions and beliefs of the group. Right-wingers or left-wingers, for example, talk only with one another. They read material that reflects their own views, and they can be almost phobic about the propaganda of the other side. The result is a deterioration of reality testing, rationality, and moral judgment. With groupthink, shared illusions of righteousness, shared illusions of superior morality or persecution, and so on remain intact. And those who challenge these beliefs are viewed with skepticism and hostility. Well, isn't that George Bush? Isn't that what our president is doing here with this Baker report? Isn't that what he's doing with the Democrats? The Republicans have their groupthink over here, and the Democrats have their groupthink over here. That's why we have gridlock in government. You know, it would seem like to me, just being a Joe Sixpack over here, that the Democrats really aren't our enemies. Well, I don't necessarily believe in their socialist philosophies or their gun-grabbing beliefs, and that if they can grab every gun in the country, we're suddenly going to have a crime-free society. I don't believe that. Evidently, Democrats do. On the other hand, the Republicans, that they seem to be with George Bush over here, well, we're going to let you keep your guns, but we're not going to repeal the gun legislation, the 25,000 regulations that we now have. Why not? I mean, when we started out in 1787, we had the Second Amendment, and we didn't have a single gun control statute. Not one. That was on day one when we started. Now I notice that we've got to have all this gun legislation. What's that going to do? Protect us from Al-Qaeda? The Al-Qaeda guys, remember, they didn't even have a gun when they hijacked those four airplanes. They were using box cutters, weren't they? What are we going to do, outlaw box cutters next? That's the mindset of the government today. Well, let's eliminate toothpaste and baby bottles. I mean, you talk about people that have lost their minds now. Just take a look at what's going on, what you see reported by Katie on the 6 o'clock news, for crying out loud. The solution to crime is we just take all the guns away from everybody. Now, let's take a look at the solution to crime. Down in Dade County, Florida, some years back, they had a rape problem down there. So they trained and armed 9,000 women in Dade County. This is Miami, Florida. I think it's Dade County. 9,000 women. Armed them. Put guns in their purses. Sent them out on the streets. And the rate of rape went from one a day to one a month in about 18 months. Led me to this conclusion. If 9,000 women in Miami can reduce the rape rate from one a day to one a month, can you imagine what would happen in Dade County if you armed every woman in Miami with a gun? I mean, you not only wouldn't have any rape, you might not have any rapists left. I mean, you'd have to import rapists from Tampa. For some reason, Democrats believe that the solution to rape is take all the guns away. Rapists don't use guns to rape women. They just grab them and rape them. But women that have guns in their purses don't get raped as often as women that get raped that don't have guns in their purses. So people like me, we have a contrarian view, and we believe that the solution to rape is to arm every woman in the country. The solution the socialists and Democrats have is, no, we disarm everybody. Let's take a look at number 20 here. Tendency to personalize hostility. Extremists often wish for the personal bad fortune of their enemies and celebrate it when it comes. So when they captured Saddam Hussein, well, they had a big party. When they killed that guy, that Al-Qaeda guy or whatever he was, I guess he is an Al-Qaeda guy, last June, they had a big celebration. They had a big extremist celebration. When a critic or an adversary dies or has a serious illness, a bad accident, or personal legal problems, extremists often rejoice and they chortle about how they deserved it. I recall seeing right-wing extremists celebrate the assassination of Martin Luther King and leftists agonizing because George Wallace survived an assassination attempt. In each instance, their hatred was not only directed against ideas, but also against individual human beings. And that's George Bush, George Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. When the Al-Qaeda guys died, they jumped up and down with glee. When they caught Saddam Hussein, wow, boy, look at this. Now that they've sentenced Saddam Hussein to death, let me make an observation here. When Saddam Hussein was running Iraq, they had stability in their government. They had electricity 24 hours a day. The sewers worked. He was a tyrant. He was a badass. He was a bad guy. And now you've deposed Saddam Hussein. You got electricity 4 hours a day. Saddam is still just as bad as he always was. And you got 3,700 people a month being killed in Baghdad alone. It would look like to me that the Iraqis were better off as a whole with Saddam Hussein than they are with George Bush and the American army. Furthermore, I would say that we Americans were better off with Saddam Hussein before we went over there to effect regime change. It was better for the 3,000 Americans who have died already, and it would have been better for the 20,000 that have had their legs and arms and their limbs blown off. Yeah. The Baker Commission agrees. They said it's grave and deteriorating. Now, the 21st extremist view or extremist trait often feel that the system is no good unless they win. For example, if an extremist loses an election, then it must have been rigged. If public opinion turns against them, it was because of brainwashing. If their followers become disillusioned, it's because of sabotage. The test of the righteous or wrongness, or the rightness or wrongness of the system is how it impacts upon them. Now, George Bush put forth a good front. He said, well, we got whipped in the election. Yeah, that's true. But have you ever noticed that politicians, you know, when they get whipped, I noticed that the patriots do this. They call the people sheeple. Sheeple, they call them. And I remember when we're talking about taxes and tax protests, you know, they say, well, the sheeple prefer the income tax because they're ignorant and don't know any better. Excuse me? Excuse me? You're saying 300 million people out there are all dumb, and you're the only one that's got any brains. I'm opposed to the income tax. I think it's a bad tax. I think it's a bad program. But, you know, in 1992, we had an opportunity to vote in a flat tax with a guy named Steve Forbes. In 1992 and 96, Forbes ran for president. And he said, let's do away with this heavy progressive income tax, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and let's put in a flat tax, a flat percentage, which is what we got with tithing in the Ten Commandments. Now, we all know that God had his head up the wrong end of his anatomy when he gave us the Ten Commandments, and that Karl Marx had it right when he gave us the heavy progressive income tax. So when Americans had to choose, they chose in 1992 Bill Clinton, who supported the income tax and the heavy progressive tax at that. And in 1996, they voted against Steve Forbes, and they elected Bill Clinton a second time. And both Bob Dole and Bill Clinton believed in and practiced and advocated the income tax. Now, boys and girls, when you have a referendum, when you've got a national candidate who stands up and says, hey, let's do this, and then the American people vote for the other guy, what is it that the people are voting for or against? So for the tax patriots or tax protesters to say that the American people are a bunch of sheeple is an extremist trait. And so when George Bush over here, when he points to the opposition over here and creates gridlock and says the Democrats are a bunch of cut-and-run cowards with yellow stripes up and down their back over here, that's an extremist trait. This guy, Murtha, you know, who is an ex-Marine from Pennsylvania, he's been against the war, I guess, from day one. I don't think that guy's got a yellow streak up his back. Do you? Honest to God, are there any Marines with yellow stripes up their backs? Past, present, or future. Marines are trained killers. Those guys charge machine gun nests knowing that they're going to die. They jump on to hand grenades and let them blow up and kill themselves to protect their buddies. I didn't see any cowards in the Marines. Well, not in the American Marines. I don't think that that exists. And yet here's our president calling these Democrats the cut-and-run party over here because this guy Murtha, who's an ex-Marine, disagrees with the president? Huh? Come on, kids. I say it's time to wake up and grow up and get real. Now, here are 21 extremist positions or traits, as Laird Wilcox calls it. And if you'd like a copy of it, you go to www.webtattoo.com. That's www.webtattoo.com/Wilcox/hoax product. Hoax product. And you'll get extremist traits, and there's 21 of them. I went through them. I was surprised that George Bush would fit into these extremist traits. And I analyzed these in comparison to George Gordon and the Gordon Law School, because I've been called an extremist, a tax protester. Oh, I've been called worse than that. But just because somebody calls me a bunch of names, you know, I'm sitting over here saying, you know, I try to be very careful about not calling other people names. Oh, I use some colorful adjectives from time to time, and I call them ragheads or something else. But the bottom line is the ragheads over here have a point of view, whether we agree with them or not. And I contend they ought to have a right to express their point of view. And for us to go over to the Middle East and take their oil away from them like we have in Saudi Arabia and Iran causes a lot of hard feelings and hate and discontent. And I don't think it's the average American that's interested in stealing the Arabs' Middle East oil. I think it's Exxon and Standard Oil and Shell and the rest of the big multinational corporations, and they've got the United States government and the United States Army at their disposal to help them steal it. And the Arabs are rejecting that bid. All right, we're about out of time again, so I'm going to have to remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide daily over the Internet. And for more information about the Gordon Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.